Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We just heard from Inez Haney Dodson, who moved into Edmondson Village in 1965 and was one of the first people of color on her street. She also broke the color line at a nearby church in that same year. And we're joined by several guests in our studio to discuss the shifting racial and class demographics in some Baltimore communities. Dr. Ed Orser wrote the book on one West Baltimore neighborhood, literally. He's the author of Blockbusting in Baltimore, the Edmondson Village Story. Dr. Orser, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we're also joined by Glenn Ross, community organizer and president of the McElderry Park Neighborhood Association. Glenn Ross, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And also with us is Baltimore City Councilman Jim Kraft, who represents District 1, which includes Patterson Park, Upper Fells Point, and Canton. Councilman Kraft, Councilman Kraft, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Orser, I'll start with you. Inez discussed in the first segment how she saw homes on her street go from being occupied by mostly white residents to mostly black residents. What was the trend she was witnessing?
As I listened to that interview, it was like 1,000 interviews. I did many for the research I did, but almost everyone was the same story, and her story was so much like others. This moment of just absolutely rapid racial change, African American moved in, for sale signs went up, people moved out. I think it's almost hard to realize now just how pervasive and how profound that change was.
This was blockbusting.
Well, it was blockbusting was the accelerator. I've always been trying to be careful to, I wouldn't say that blockbusting caused the kind of change that happened, but it certainly accelerated it, and it left people victims on both sides. But Inez speaks about the victimization of black purchasers who very often could not get loans through mainstream banks. In fact, most typically couldn't. So only could get the loan to buy the house through the blockbuster or through the agent. Nobody called themselves a blockbuster, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm careful about that term is that people who were engaged in this enterprise, their defense was they were making housing available to African Americans and others in a situation where they had been totally excluded. So that was a reality. But the kind of buy-to-rent contract that she described was one that left a person very vulnerable. She mentioned she couldn't get money for repairs, but that was almost the least of the problems because you missed one payment, one monthly payment, and all you'd put in could be taken away. So these were very, very shaky arrangements, and they were only possible, again, because the mainstream banking industry, the mainstream real estate institutions would not make these loans available.
And why do you say victims on both sides?
Well, I think whites were victimized too, and I think one could say they victimized themselves, and that needs to be said, of course. But the panic that resulted in this kind of situation meant that many sold their houses way, way below what the houses were worth, and for many, that was the only equity they had. That was their sort of life saving. And for them, it was something out of control, and they fled. So one could, again, say they were victimizing themselves, but from their point of view, they felt they were caught.
Before all this happened, was Edmondson Village a middle-class neighborhood?
I think generally one would use that term. Those terms are sometimes a little hard to use, but this was a sort of, I think, upper working class, lower middle class community. And I point out in the book that African Americans who moved in actually very closely resembled those same characteristics. So that in the initial period, blacks moving in typically were same occupational status. But whites didn't wait around to determine that. As far as they were concerned, this had been a white community. It was unspoken. You know, I, if you look back to the real estate ads in the 20s, 30s, 40s, when this area was built, they never said blacks aren't welcome. They didn't have to say it. And everybody knew that. And so whites had grown up in that world where they expected that they could live a very separate kind of life.
And what about finances, income level? Did that change sharply at the time? Or?
It did not change sharply immediately. Over time, it began to change some. But again, the first settlers, African-American settlers, typically were people who were working class and sort of lower middle class. I mean, again, I hate to use that terminology. That's not the most accurate terminology. But nevertheless, that was generally the case.
Councilman Kraft, let's talk about Patterson Park. I'm not sure whether it's the same or similar or different pattern there. Historically, Patterson Park was white, blue-collar residents.
Right. Right. Very ethnic. And yet the neighborhoods over there have pretty much retained a lot of the ethnicity. We didn't have the same experience that they had in Edmondson Village or northeast Baltimore or even just further north above Patterson Park. When you get into the Highlandtown area or the Canton area, we did see some of the actions that Ed references in the larger townhomes along Baltimore Street and the Butchers Hill area, were houses that had been at one time single-family grand homes that were converted into 5, 6, 7, 8 apartments in in a unit, but we didn't see the large transformation to the African American versus white community that had happened in so many of these other areas. We see today a change in the diversity. The ethnicity we see today is more Latino. That's happened over the last probably 10 to 15 years, but not in the same with the same mechanisms that were there in place then.
I'm trying to understand what was the driving force in making the Patterson Park area more diverse than blue collar whites. What shifted?
A lot of the folks just moved.
Because?
I mean, because they got older. And the other thing is they got a little more money. So they moved, they migrated eastward. So if you took like Little Italy as an example, you had the Italian families there that moved from Little Italy, and then they moved to Highlandtown. They moved to Our Lady of Pompeii, and they moved from church to church. So you had St. Leo's Catholic Church, and then they went to Our Lady of Pompeii, and then they moved a little further east, and they went to Our Lady of Fatima, and they just kept moving out in little newer housing each time. Housing had a little bit bigger of a yard, and then they had, then they moved over into Graceland Park, where they had a bigger yard, to Sacred Heart of Mary, and then down into St. Rita's and Dundalk. There's this migration eastward, and you see this happening, and then you see the migration going outward. But you have a traditional working class, and I say working class because most of the folks that lived in the neighborhood and continue to live in the neighborhood until really the industrial plants really started closing up, the canneries, the Bethlehem Steel, the shipyards, Martins, all those things in the 70s and 80s where those jobs all dried up.
But and was that a big factor, the jobs
very
drying
large,
up?
Very large factor, because most of those people that lived down there, that's where they made their living, and that's where they had made their living for generations. Even a number of the auto workers who worked there continued to live there when the auto working jobs went out to White Marsh. So you still had a good number of people because the UAW was still headquartered down in southeast Baltimore, down in Greektown. So you still had those folks migrating to work out of the old neighborhood to the new location.
So was there a period when you had actually coexisting white residents and black residents?
Oh, we did. We did. We have some in the Highlandtown area. And some of that happened, and Glenn might have a better sense on this, but some of that happened when they tore down some of the public housing over on the west side. I think it was the Murphy Homes. And there was a relocation of a good number of those folks into the Highlandtown area. And that caused probably the biggest shift in the racial dynamic in Highland Town and Patterson Park, probably in the last 30 to 40 years.
And how would you describe the racial dynamic then?
That's when, if you talk to folks who lived in the neighborhood then, they would say that the city blockbusted their neighborhood. I mean, they would say that when the city took city housing, infill housing that the city owned or the city had control over, and moved the folks from the Murphy homes into those vacant houses, that had this almost the same effect as when the folks that were doing block busting in the Edmondson Village area or in the Chum area or some of these other areas of the city, they would describe the effect as the same. When the folks moved in from the Murphy's home, then all of a sudden, white folks who were in those blocks and had been in those blocks in some cases for generations
decided
to leave. And yeah,
Glenn Ross, you grew up in Southeast Baltimore, right?
No, I grew up in East Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
But went to school in Southeast Baltimore, played down in Patterson Park. This would be my second time of experiencing this. Once as a child, in the what was called the Fort Worthington community, now the Berea community. Then I have an opportunity, unfortunately, to see it again. I moved 500 block north Milton Avenue in 1980 as a single parent with two children. And I was one of the first African-Americans to be a homeowner in that area. So,
and I want to ask you about that, but reflect back a little further. What do you remember from the 60s, 70s? What the dynamic was?
Well, it was all white community. I do remember that to the north of the Patterson Park, all the way up to Eager Street, when I was a kid in junior high school, everything south of Eager Street was Highland Town. But as minorities moved in, Highland Town boundaries moved. That's what I had experienced throughout the years. But it was always a predominantly white community. And like I said, I moved in there 31 years ago. And when I moved in, I expected a little racial confrontation. You know, I mean, it wasn't that bad. But we also saw white flight. And I think because of race and what we see on the TV and read in the papers, it's just scared a lot of those long-time whites that have lived there. But I think what people didn't understand is that we that moved in that area as African-Americans, we came from working-class families. We came from neighborhoods that family values, community pride. And I strongly believe that if the white flight wasn't as high as what it was, those neighborhoods would have been able to stabilize a lot longer. But that race just killed it. Oh, what I also noticed is that so many houses were unoccupied because people moved and nobody was buying. And I purchased my home through neighborhood housing services. So they was helping minorities to move into the community. But we kept seeing that decrease in white home ownership, that neighborhood housing services created neighborhood rental services so that they can purchase these properties and have a hold on the housing market of owning these properties.
I'm a little confused. You're talking about making homes available as rentals or selling them to?
Well, they started off as home ownership. But the white flight was so high, neighborhood housing service created neighborhood rental services so that they can have control of those houses, rent them out, and eventually maybe got them rehab and turn them back into home ownership. But the decrease of white home ownership was so rapid. The other transformation that I've seen in the community is that since these homeowners that moved away, that wanted to be landlords, they really couldn't sell the working families because they weren't moving in the neighborhood. Crime started coming up. We started receiving poor city service. There was a total disconnect. But then when they started tearing down public housing, what we realized that these property owners that couldn't get the $500-$600 a month rent, they can now get $1,200 a month for Section 8. Now, I'm not seeing anything wrong with Section 8 or Section 8 people. But, you know, when you have generations of people who have grew up in public housing, they live in a different living environment. You know, and what I refer to is, I'm dramatized here, high-rise, low-rise. People have a trash problem. In high-rise, they throw it in a chute out of sight, out of mind. Low-rise, you throw it in a dumpster. So when people move into neighborhoods like McGeldry Park or Bel Air Edison, when you have generations of people coming from out of public housing, they don't come with lawnmowers, weed whackers, you know, hedge cutters. That doesn't happen. And we strong, as a community consultant activist, I really feel that our city government at that time, if they knew they were bringing in a lot of people from public housing, they should have put in those maintenance services right along with it. And because of that, what I've noticed was that a lot of working African Americans started moving out the community.
So it wasn't just white flight?
No, it wasn't just white flight.
That's Glenn Ross, president of the McGeldry Park Neighborhood Association, here on Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also speaking with Baltimore City Councilman Jim Kraft, who represents much of Southeast Baltimore, and Dr. Ed Orser, author of Blockbusting in Baltimore, The Edmondson Village Story. We're talking about factors that have led to demographic changes in some Baltimore neighborhoods. Glenn Rush, you have lived in McGeldry Park for 30-some years, right?
Yes.
It's just north of Patterson Park, where housing prices have risen, businesses are flourishing. Has that growth spilled over into your neighborhood?
We can see it growing. Everything is, all the redevelopment is coming from the south, coming from the Boston Street. And we're beginning to see some changes coming in. We, you know, the neighborhood associations are beginning to get a lot stronger. My experience is that the neighborhood groups south of Fayette Street have always been stronger neighborhoods. Patterson Place, the old Baltimore Linwood, Butchers Hill, Washington Hill. But because of, you know, what I call neighbors decaying. Once the neighbors start decaying, you start losing people. Those people you're losing are those better educated, financially stable, those people with the resources and technical skills moved out of the community. So the leadership wasn't always that strong. So we have had our struggles throughout the years, but now we have fought hard for over 14 years to have like Habitat for Humanity on the Chesapeake to come into our community and start purchasing these vacant properties. But for years, the powers that be kept blocking that. I work for Councilman Warren Branch, and since he's been in office, Habitat on both sides of Fayette Street have purchased a vacant property and turned them into home ownership. So we're beginning to see this growth happening, mainly, I would say, from Fairmount to Monument Street. And now you have other investors coming in, gutting and rehabbing their property. So we have seen the shift of crime, mainly along Jefferson Street in our community. But that's changing because of home ownership. I just personally feel that this system has us fighting one another because of race, economic level, and all this stuff is a smokescreen. And I think that people need to understand that we can try to fight battles like this. I'm holding my hands open, fingers spread wide, but we fight better like this when we all pull together and fight together. So we're trying in McGeldry Park break those disconnects with our community stakeholders and say we're all in this pot together, you know, and we all got to work at for the betterment of our community.
City Councilman Kraft, what do you see in terms of those kinds of struggles in lots of communities, or
the I think the race issue is, and I think Glenn is accurate, it's probably the biggest hurdle that we have to continually get over in the city. It's an unstated hurdle, but it is there all the time. In my district, I don't have to deal with it quite as much in terms of the African American issue because they're not the majority minority party in my population in my district. The majority minority population in my district is Latino. My majority, you know, majority of my district is white. And then I have a large Latino population and a growing Latino population. And I have a pretty stable, if not declining, African American population. Glenn's area actually benefits by the strengthening of my area because we're just south of his in this, and because we are pretty solid, particularly as we get stronger above the park, McGeldry Park borders right on our Patterson Park neighborhoods. So we have we're very complementary in that area. But the tension that I have in my neighborhood today is really the tension between the white community and the Latino community. It really is not a lot of tension between the African American community and the white community, because there just is not a whole lot of pressure there. My African American community that I have is pretty segregated, for lack of a better word. I mean, it's public housing in O'Donnell Heights. There is some degree of African-American population in the northeast quadrant up just north of Highland Avenue, Baltimore and Highland. And there really is not much other than that in any concentrated effort. And the African-American population that I do have is professional, socioeconomically the same as the socioeconomic level, and it has just blended in. There's really no distinction because the socioeconomic levels are all the same. So you don't have that conflict within where it is there. There is not a real conflict. The conflict really in my district is in two areas. It's in the greater Highland Town area, where we have the growing Hispanic Latino population, and in the Broadway corridor, where it pushes up against the old ethnic neighborhoods in Upper Fells Point and Fells Prospect. That's where, you know, we still have some clash in terms of race.
Let me make sure I understand that. When you say there, the conflict that exists is, how does it express itself?
It's not in anger, it's not in violence, it is just in frustration. It's in the sense of, in some ways, it's an unknown versus unknown, in that you have folks that are older who have been in the community for generations. You have folks that have just moved in. There's language difference, cultural difference. So there's that unknown factor. And then there is, so you have the fear of the unknown. Then you have the socioeconomic difference, because you have working class folks who have worked very hard to own their homes, have both basically retired, who are meeting working class families, because most of the Latino folks, the one thing that have moved in, they're not there because they work all the time, but there you have the experience of the true immigrant experience, in that you have families come and they've got brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, and they're all coming and living, you know, in the same house. So you have all the historic
tensions
happening there. I mean, it's exciting. It's exciting. The diversity is exciting. And once the folks get to know one another, the neighborhoods are working well together. It's just that initial stress of, you know, the unknown between them. But that's really the only areas that we're having any racial pressure or some degree of antagonism manifest right now in Southeast.
Ed Orser, what are the benefits of diversity? I mean, what does a neighborhood or a community get out of diversity that neighborhoods that aren't diverse are missing?
Well, I personally cling to the view that you get a lot, that there's real value in the interaction across race lines, across class lines. We have probably more examples of some racial interaction than class interaction because, of course, the suburbs have typically been sort of middle-class preserves. But I think that as I was thinking back to the difference between these communities we've talked about, that what we're left with in so many parts of the city, and I know the West Side better, but these gentlemen have spoken about the East, a period of tremendous destabilization that occurred. Those barriers had to break down, but the way they broke down was in such rapid fashion and in such a victimizing way that it left neighborhoods that were really blighted. You had asked me about the sort of the social class, the economic class of blacks who moved into the neighborhood, and I made the comment that the initial settlers were really very comparable. But whites who had the same economic status didn't wait around long enough to discover that was the fact. And in fact, I interviewed people who would say, if I'd only known, but you know, they were acting on the basis of these long-held fears, the whole notion that just was beyond their comprehension that there could be such a thing as an interracial neighborhood. So, but the result was destabilization, and it was destabilization both because people moved in rapidly and moved out rapidly, but there were other things too. I mentioned the mortgages that were very shaky for new settlers. The prices they paid, what we didn't talk about blockbusting is that blockbusters jacked the prices up. So blacks had to pay what some activists called the black tax in order to even gain access to these neighborhoods. And then when you have rapid change of that kind, even if the initial settlers are a rather stable middle class, upper working class group, the chances of the neighborhood remaining that way maybe aren't so great. Over time, there are going to be vacant houses at times. There could be people who can't keep up those mortgages. And as Glenn was mentioning, then what also began to happen was that as other opportunities opened up wonderfully, many middle-class African-Americans moved on to neighborhoods that did seem to be more advantageous and stable. And so you have the loss of a black middle class in many neighborhoods. A lot of these neighborhoods still have a lot of strength, but they have blight, too. If you go along Edmondson Avenue and you see the houses along Edmondson Avenue, you see a lot of boarded-up houses. If you drive back and walk back two or three blocks, you see some well-maintained houses. So it's a more of a mixed pattern than people may realize. But still, I think the impact is very, very great.
As much homage as we pay to the idea of diversity, at least some people do, Glenn Ross, do communities do enough to make diversity work? I mean, is there more that the communities need to do?
Well, I strongly feel that those better affluent neighborhoods get more resources to work with to do that. My neighborhood in particular, I'm saying the neighborhoods between Monument and Fayette, really wasn't getting those resources. And it's kind of hard to organize people when you have so many dynamics coming in that's causing people to stay separated. And I mentioned before about breaking the disconnects. I've been in that area, like I said, for a long time. My benefits was I was able to work with those strong umbrella groups to the south, CECO that has just recently dissolved, and Banner Neighborhoods, where we were able to get people from the more affluent communities better organized to come and help us to organize. So we broke the disconnect right there by doing that. And I think it's one of the reasons why our neighborhoods are getting a lot stronger, because we learned more from the better neighborhoods. But I really put my finger at our city government. As Councilman Kraft said, 10, 15 years ago is when we start seeing the movement of a lot of Latinos moving in, you know, and within that time period, people in public housing, and it's a terrible disconnect. And I personally feel that if the city knew that you have a large population of Hispanics moving in the neighborhood, people that come from different living environments, the city should have created some type of program to help create some type of culture exchange type program to make that transition much easier. So in our neighborhoods, we have to be gifted and create our own type of programs and start working outside of the box to make things right. I just want to use as an example real quick. We have a Latino supermarket on the corner of Monument Orleans, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is the fifth owner. He's having the same problems as the first four. They're selling food that's in Spanish. You know, they lose money. You know, so we don't speak Spanish. They have fruits and vegetables. We don't know if it's a fruit or vegetable. People come into meetings complaining that they're selling rotten bananas. They're plantains. It's a disconnect. Mm. So the city should help create, and will help us to create, culture exchange type programs where we can start working and living together to maintain the stability of our community.
Well, let me ask Councilman. I was going to ask you, Councilman Kraft, what the community should do, but Mr. Ross raises the question of what the city needs to do to make diversity work. Let me get your thoughts.
Well, it's interesting because in our area, I think the largest thing the city could do in our area would be, number one, in the area of education. A good number of my schools now, the elementary schools, the majority of the children in the elementary schools, or close to the majority of the children in the elementary school, are Latinos. Mm-hmm. And so we really need bilingual teachers, bilingual administrators, and we don't have the number that we need. So we really need percentage of administrators that we need to adequately serve those children. So we really need to focus on that in the education department, and that's going to make a major difference. Now, the other side of that is, and this is where it's truly interesting, because we see what's happening is what happened in my generation, where you had folks who are now my age, mid-60s, whose parents and grandparents came from Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. who were first generation, came, and they learned their English from their children. Mm-hmm. So we have the same thing here, where the children, the first grader, second grader, is now teaching the parents' children. So the assimilation's coming from the children. So we see that. But the city could do a much better job if it were unifying its resources, in the sense that we have a multiplicity of groups trying to serve the Hispanic Latino community. And, you know, many of them have overlapping goals, providing overlapping services, and we divide our money up among them, whereas the city should really be working with them to get them to either reduce the number of groups or coordinate the services they're operating so that we can better use the amount of funds that they have, which would allow us to do a better job at focusing and providing the type of services that Glenn's talking about. One other thing the city really has failed at, let me do this. I wanted to, one thing the city has been excellent at and one that they failed at. One that they failed at is really being able to get into the neighborhoods where the Latino folks live, and that is, in a block-by-block basis to get to know those folks, because they come from so many different countries, and they really are divided by culture. So when people say it's Latino, and you know, the I don't know how it is in Glenn's neighborhood, but everybody's a Mexican. You know, it doesn't matter what country you come to.
Glenn, you're nodding your head. What is your experience?
No, that's true. That's true.
It's exactly everybody's a Mexican. So you never get to the, you know, where the folks exactly with a specific country. But the one thing the city has done an excellent job of, and that is saying that it doesn't matter where you're from, as far as we're concerned, you're a Baltimorean. You know, we are not in the immigration business. You know, we are in the job of taking care of our citizens, and we're in the job of taking care of our people. And that's made a big difference in terms of our being able to take the next step, and that is, you know, to get the kids in school and to get the parents to some degree be able to work with the kids in the school and to, you know, get some of the folks involved getting health care and other city services. So that's been a positive thing. But just getting into the neighborhoods to try to be able to get those cultures identified and get those cultures working with one another, that we could be doing a lot better job than that.
We've been talking about diverse communities at different socioeconomic levels. I mean, there's a fair amount of affluence in Patterson Park these days. That's not true of all the communities we've been talking about. How does diversity play out differently in neighborhoods with higher incomes compared to lower incomes? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, I was thinking back to what I'd said about blockbusting, that part of what was so distressing about its impact and the impact of that period of just massive racial change was that everything happened too fast. And I think when we've seen things slow down, and Glenn and Jim both were talking about examples when you have neighbors begin to talk to neighbors, when you have neighbors joining one another in a community association, and when you have it not unusual for there to be people of different races at the table or next door, that I think is such a wonderful step. And I think we've seen some of that happening in the aftermath, but it's taken a while to settle down. And I think it's now, you know, if we really look at the daily interactions that many of us have, it's not unusual to have interaction across racial lines, whereas it was so totally unusual in the 60s and before. So I think anything that kind of slows it down, that has people joining together about parks, about schools, about neighborhoods, those are where we have common interest and where we do see some real interaction.
Has the housing crisis helped slow things down? Is there anything good to be said about that?
Well, in the CARE community and McGeldry Park, that's once again between Fayette and Monument Street, 14 years ago, we were able to create our own community redevelopment plan. And we had Habitat for Humanity of Baltimore was at the table. But as I mentioned earlier, they were being denied to purchase any vacant property in the area. We know that we're in the AM and PM shadows of the Johns Hopkins Medical Institution. I've been involved with Hopkins for 30 years, but we understand that game. Hopkins is really not interested in moderate and low-income housing around their campus. They want upper-income housing. The bad thing about that is that too many upper-income housing in the neighborhood, people like myself who stayed and fought and tried to do what we can to help stabilize our community, we wouldn't afford to stay there. So in our development plan, we want low, moderate, and upper-income housing. But like I said, as soon as Council Branch had won the election in McGeldry Park and CARE, they have bought a multitude of vacant properties and just transformed that whole particular area just with new homeowners. And you have homeowners of different races. I mean, here in our particular area, we have Latinos, whites, African-Americans working on our community gardens together. We're interacting with each other. So it's beginning to gel up in that area, but we gotta have those activities, okay? And a lot of times to have activities, we need funding. So we have learned to tap into the untapped resources in neighborhoods like ours, and that's college students. And these college students are the ones who have come into our communities. And, you know, they got on the internet and, you know, they found those programs, they found that those funding opportunities to help us to create these cultural exchange type programs. So I've been president for 19 years in McGeldry Park. I've been gone for 10, and I'm back about 9 months as president. So I'm just going back and tapping to those resources. The resources are there, but if the leadership or the community aren't given those resources or nowhere to go, then they're left out the loop.
Last question. What kind of resources are available beyond Glenn Ross talks about discovering some magically here and there by smart use of the internet, but I mean, when citizens come to you with an idea, we'd like to do this or that, what do you tell them, Councilman Kraft, about where they might find
money
to do it?
I really think it depends on what specifically they're looking for, and my district is so different from any other district in the city, with probably the exception of Councilman Cole, who represents downtown and Federal Hill and the Charles Street corridor. Our needs are different. I mean, I have tremendous economic development. I mean, the housing crisis, you know, hurt us. The good side, there was one good side of the housing crisis, and that is it killed some of the speculators. But, you know, the bad side of it was it stopped growth for a while. But, you know, our growth is starting up again. When people come to me and, you know, by and large, I mean, they're looking for something. They're looking for development money. I mean, they're looking for, you know, $1 million, $3 million, $10 million. They're looking for partners. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for putting together pieces of property in order to do a development. They're not looking for the money for a single home mm-hmm. to be able to do that. So it's a whole different dynamic. Or they're looking for, you know, money to do improvements to the park, or, you know, to put a swimming pool in a playground. So, you know, our needs are so different than, you know, the basic subsistence needs that are going on in so many of the other districts. I mean, we're really talking about when the mayor says, you know, I want to grow the city by 10,000 families in the next 10 years. Well, you know, my families are the families that are here. They're the families that, you know, we're saying, okay, you're here, you're having your children, don't leave. So we want to provide those families with the services. We want to make sure that they have great parks. We want to make sure they have great schools so that they don't leave, because they're providing the beginning of that tax base that we need to be able to have and to grow in order to be able to provide the services that, you know, that a lot of the constituents in Glenn's district and other districts around the city don't have the benefits that we have, because, you know, it's a big city. And some areas have, you know, they have growth, they have money, they have more of a an immediate future than other areas do, and those areas have to be there to help, you know, the other parts of the city until those areas get on their feet.
Well, I appreciate you all talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glenn Ross is president of the McElderry Park Neighborhood Association for the second time. City Councilman Jim Kraft represents much of Southeast Baltimore, and Dr. Ed Orser is author of Blockbusting in Baltimore, The Edmondson Village Story. For more of this interview, visit WYPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning Link. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. Now, we had some other questions, but it looks like we don't really have time for them. Okay. Could you give me another 2 minutes, each
sure,
of you?
Sure.
Okay. Councilman Kraft, I wanted to get you to talk about NECO. You were an organizer for the Northeast
NECO.
The Northeast Community Organization.
Yes, many years ago.
What did NECO do, and what did
We were an umbrella organization, very similar to CECO. We had, I think, about 140 community associations representing Northeast Baltimore. This was back in the late 60s and early 70s, and we were organizers. We were trained by people who had learned under Saul Alinsky, mm-hmm. And we did a lot of the early anti-blockbusting work in Northeast Baltimore. A lot of the stuff that Ed wrote about, you know, we worked on in Homestead Montebello, before it was CHUM, before it was Coldstream Homestead Montebello. We worked in that area all along the Clifton.
What did you do to try to stop
blockbusting? We were very instrumental in doing stuff dealing with the redlining laws, banning for sale signs in the city of Baltimore, you know, breaking down the, it used to be in the newspapers, they had a difference between Baltimore City houses being for sale and Baltimore County houses being for sale. We stopped them from having those distinctions. It just said Baltimore. You recall that we were involved in those fights. We did a lot of individual just community organizing in terms of the block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, creating associations. We did a lot of work in, like I say, Homestead Montebello. We did a lot of work in the Morgan State Corridor along Paring Parkway and Lock Raven Road. A lot of our early organizational people, John Carroll Burns, who is now retired, but he was a state senator, he was a judge here, was one of our really early activists there. And Ed Kane, who was ran the water taxi, mm-hmm. he was one of our early folks, but a lot of people who went on to do a lot of other community type things here in the community worked.
What did you learn during those years that you still find yourself drawing on today? What sort of in the front of your mind some days?
How to put people together. How to put people together, and how to identify issues, and how to work toward getting people to own the issue themselves. And that's really, really important that people own the issue themselves, because it's easy for someone to come in and say, you got this problem. But unless people believe that it's their issue and they need to solve it, you can't move forward, because you can solve it for them the first time, or you can point them in a direction, but unless they own it, it's not going anywhere.
Glenn, you have been critical of developers and institutions' involvement in your neighborhood and other East Baltimore neighborhoods. Speak to me about development's role in increasing diversity and limiting diversity.
Yes, I've been very critical. And throughout the years, I've been very critical of the 800-pound gorilla, Johns Hopkins. But, you know, you have to understand information is important and things are done on purpose. What I've learned once I got into Hopkins and saw the programs and projects that they were doing, I was rather impressed. But the problem is that when Hopkins did research projects or programs in certain neighborhoods, they have a tendency of researchers and faculty have a tendency of going to corporate Hopkins, who talks to our so-called powers to be in East Baltimore, and they would dictate what neighborhood organization, what faith group, or what individual to do business with, as long as they're politically correct. Many of us are not politically correct. So what we have learned to do is to go inside Hopkins. Since we are not the politically correct ones, we can't get to talk to corporate Hopkins. So what we've learned is going from the bottom, from the students. These are future health people that will want to help the community. And what we learned is that we learned how to get these programs and projects back into our community. The whole development piece, we're watching, I want to refer to the Biotech Science Park. I mean, when you look at that neighborhood was designed to decay, right across the street from Johns Hopkins, north of Madison. I mean, 30, 40 years that neighborhood just decayed. You have 28 to 42 houses in the street block, and you may only have 6 or 7 people living on the street, but that neighborhood was allowed to decay to bring down the market value. The thing about working with college students, okay, and community-friendly faculty people of all colleges, is that they had helped us to do two contemporary arts museum, two exhibits. One was the history of East Baltimore. We went back 80 years, and as Mr. Councilman Kraft said, when all the steel mills, the factory was booming, the African-American and white community, everybody was working, they had money, sending kids to college, they had transportation, we had programs in our community, but what happened when they all closed up at one time? The second exhibit was called Investigating the Creation of the Ghetto and showed how it tied into the prison complex in East Baltimore. We can do this on the west side as well, but in East Baltimore, we were able to go back 80 years and track the decayed neighborhood in East Baltimore on the southeast pattern, coming from Greenmount Avenue to Harford Road, the Oliver community, east of Broadway, Broadway East, Madison East End, that's now the Biotech, came in my neighborhood 15 years ago. Now all that confusion is all down by Holland and Lombard, down by the Santonis, where the shopping center is. We were able to show the decrease of home ownership. We were able to track the increase of 911, 311 calls. We were able to track the poor city service. One of the amazing things I say that I personally feel that it takes anywhere from 20 to 30, 35 years to decay a community. And behind every decayed community is a redevelopment plan that does not include the people that live there. And that's what we were able to prove. We were also able to prove who were buying up the properties in the decayed neighborhoods and the next neighborhood to be decayed, so that they can turn these houses into Section 8 houses. I was called the whistleblower. This is when Commissioner Dan Henson was the housing commissioner, because we had this general superintendent, Jack Reed, was one of the biggest slum landlords in our neighborhood. I just wanted to expose him. Once the Sun Papers did the report, it was like a domino effect. There was personnel and housing in different city agencies, some politicians and their family members, who were purchasing these houses. And we have, they had photos, pictures of these houses in the newspaper. Some of these houses were uninhabitable, but there was approved Section 8 housing. So we look at this and say, wait a minute, poor neighbors and ghettos just don't happen. They're created.
And you've believed that you've created evidence that it is purposeful as opposed to a set of unintended consequences?
Yes, and that's why the Baltimore City paper called it the best exhibit for 2007. Because, like I said, working with college students, they're the ones that got on the internet. They're the ones that got on there and got or worked with the five community advocates in East Baltimore. And we just all got together and they listened to our stories. Okay, we showed them our documentation. We all have archives. And they put all that piece together and helped us to put together those two exhibits.
Ed Orser, talk to me about Edmondson Village now and also Uplands development.
Well, the Uplands development is very interesting, and of course, it's just beginning, so a little hard to know how it will turn out. What I found quite interesting as a historian of this area is that when James Keelty and his company began to build row houses in the Edmondson Village area in the 20s and into the 30s, they built it as a suburb. They built it as country living with the convenience of the city. Now, when I would tell my students that and they think about the row house neighborhood like Edmondson Village, they say, that's not suburbs, that's city. But at that time, it was the edge of the city. There was green space. It was up a little bit on the hill from the downtown. It had the feel of a suburb. And what I found interesting about the Uplands, as I see the billboards along Edmondson, is that they're promising that same thing, country living in an urban setting. They are, by the way, those same billboards show multiracial images. Whether that will be the case, I really couldn't say. It's still too early to know. But I think it's very interesting the way that development at least is projecting itself. The Edmondson Village area, and I'm talking about the greater area, not just, say, the shopping center, is certainly seeing elements of decay. I mentioned particularly along the avenue, and there are the blue light cameras, and there are the issues about crime. I think the generation that settled that neighborhood, and some are still there, have had a very good life in that neighborhood. I think the question is the future. And when I interviewed young people and asked them where they hope to live in the future, they said places like Fells Point or Columbia or Owings Mills. And so I think trying to make neighborhoods like that attractive for a younger generation is a real challenge. And I go back to the conversation with that both of these gentlemen have raised, and that is that jobs are so critical. And we had a presidential campaign where both candidates say that they're going to produce jobs. And we know that politicians can do some of that, but really, that's not the, you know, main. It really has to come from the private sector. And so I think the biggest challenge for Baltimore is finding new employment opportunities. And that's very directly related to education. I think we're making strides. I feel very positive about many of the things that are happening. But that's going to have to continue to be the real thrust as far as city government's concerned, because that really is the future. And you get this sort of vicious circle where employers say, well, there's not an educated workforce, so we're not going to locate here. We have to have an educated workforce so those employers do locate here.